that point.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, February the 4th, 2011. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here today by my co-host, Carissa Thorpe and Alyssa Ray. On today's show, we have two interviews for you. First up, we'll have Jeff Ertin, the Farm Animal Welfare Coordinator of the BCSPCA, on the show to speak to us about some new upcoming federal farm animal welfare initiatives in Canada. Earlier last year, the Canadian federal government announced $3.4 million in funding for animal welfare projects, including new codes of practice for the national for the care and handling of farm animals to be developed under the leadership of the National Farm Animal Care Council. I'm really interested in finding out more about these codes of practice and what measures they will entail for the betterment of the animals. And Jeff will be speaking to us about this today. For our feature interview, we'll be speaking with Neil DeCruz, who is a wildlife biologist with a special interest in bears and works for the World Society for Protection of Animals. We'll be talking to him about an animal abuse and exploitation issue that I think is not that well known about in the Western world, and that is an issue that is the issue to a group of people in India who illegally capture bears to force them to dance as entertainment to people and as a means of living. This is a story with a backstory that goes into the culture of a people who grow up being used to keeping and abusing animals in this way so that it's just a normal way of life for them. We'll be learning all about this dancing bear trade and how WISPA has been involved with it. And now it's time to do the draw for our CD giveaway for a copy of the vegan band Green Beans music CD called Electric Green. We announced this giveaway contest a couple weeks ago, and we've been playing such entertaining songs from it in recent months, such as Jesus Was a Flexitarian, Where Do You Get Your Protein, and Meat Doesn't Grow on Trees. Green Beans is an eco-veggie conscious pop band writing and performing humorous and incisive songs about responsible food choices and the environment. So we actually only had one person enter the draw. By default, Luvena Kwong is the winner. Congratulations, Luvena. We'll be in touch with you shortly on how you can claim your prize, and good for her for entering. So this was an exciting week on the Oprah show. Oprah Winfrey has yet again taken on a short-term challenge of veganism, but this time with 378 of her staff members. Do you want to tell us about this, Carissa?
I was really excited that this was happening and to watch the show. And there were some points, though, where it seemed like meat was being promoted a bit more than the veganism, but I still think that talking about veganism on such a mainstream show as Oprah, like, some people are almost religious about the way that they watch Oprah and follow Oprah. One woman even wrote a book based on sort of like the phenomenon. She followed Oprah for a year. It was called Living Oprah.
Yeah.
Where it's not even that she's into Oprah. It was just sort of like, people do this, so I'm going to try it for a year. So I think that it has the potential to have a lot of influence. And I'm really interested to see how it sort of develops from here. Like, she said that her partner Stedman went vegan as well, and he was really excited about it, and he wants to continue doing it. So I'm hoping that maybe she'll keep talking about veganism on the show, or maybe have a follow-up show about it.
Yeah, it's her last season, so I don't know if there'll be a follow-up, but there was one staff member on her show who lost 11 pounds in 1 week.
Yeah.
Another guy said that he was taking like 7 to 8, I think, antacids a day, and now he's not anymore, and he had all these problems that, you know, hypertension and all kinds of problems that are associated with eating meat, and that he just felt great now. He was continuing with it. So I think that was amazing. Out of the 378 staff members who followed this veganism for a week, there was a total of 444 pounds lost between them all.
Yeah.
So in 1 week, and 84 pounds were gained, maybe because they were just eating too well, and 78 people quit. So 300 people kept up with it. So
which is still impressive. And I really like that Oprah was saying that they're going to start having meatless Mondays now. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely something that other people will hopefully take into account and consider. I think they were saying that there was, I think they were trying to imply that there was someone on staff that already was vegan. Because they
said, one person?
Yeah. Like
that's it?
They said someone's name, like, oh, could we maybe start having options for Rose or something? Like, as though this person has been, like, begging, can we please have something that I can eat in the cafeteria?
I didn't know that she mentioned a name.
So they've said that they're going to at least have the vegan options from now on.
That's great to hear. So there was Michael Pollan on the show, who's they called a rock star in the food world, and Kathy Freston, who's the author of Quantum Wellness and the new book called Veganist, which incidentally went number one on Amazon on the day that the Oprah show aired.
I wonder how that happened.
Well, geez, all of her books go, or all the books mentioned on Oprah go number one, right? So I think that's a positive spin. But what were some things that we didn't like about the show?
I definitely didn't like the way that Michael Pollan seemed to just be, I don't know, he seemed like a meat cheerleader, being like, meat isn't evil, and I eat it a couple times a week.
And, well, we know that, right? He was sort of the opposing view, or maybe the middle ground view.
Except they kind of... I don't know, I felt when, I've never read his books or anything like that, so I kind of felt when they introduced him, like he was supposed to be on the vegan side as well, is sort of how it seemed to come across, and then he just kept throwing in like, oh no, eat meat, it's okay, like...
Yeah, he did say there's the one part I didn't like about it was he said, I have two problems with veganism. One is that we need to support the farmers, so which makes no sense. As I was saying before, it's like an analogy to saying, well, we shouldn't ban smoking because we need to support the tobacco growers, right? There are fruit and vegetable farmers that we can support.
Yeah, and
right?
There would be more of them if there were less meat.
So that's a cop-out excuse. And then he did mention, too, that we shouldn't be eating so many processed foods, which is totally true, right?
Yeah.
So I think the show, when they were showing, Kathy Freston was showing one of the staffers how to shop, and she was showing all my favorite vegan substitute products.
Yeah.
You know, like the daya cheese and tofurkey sausages and all that good stuff. You don't have to eat that, but I think for people transitioning, that's why she was showing those products, right? So because people need to know, what do I replace my sausage with? What do I eat for cheese? So that was why. You know, the show ended on a note where Kathy Freston said, well, Michael Pollan said, there's nothing evil about meat. And Kathy said, I totally agree with you. I'm not sure what she meant by that.
Yeah.
But then she went on to say, but it doesn't sit right in my soul. Can I look into the eyes of an animal and say that your suffering is worth the meat on my plate? And hopefully, I'm hoping that that's what people really took away with them. So, you know, we could talk about this more, but we've got to play a PRA.
Women in a Changing Downtown East Side has been a part of a collective effort over many months to look at the impact of gentrification, oppression, poverty, and racism on women in the Downtown East Side of Vancouver, and to build a library of resources, maps, information, and images around this community and its history. While many who call this neighborhood home are negatively impacted by these issues, as well as by a life in society that is growing ever more polarized, we know that it is women who are particularly vulnerable to the increasing displacement and disenfranchisement that is taking place in this both vibrant and suffering community. The culmination of Women in a Changing Downtown East Side project is a multifaceted website, womendtes.com, a website for everyone. Scholars, visitors, locals, and anyone interested in learning more about this community and about the way in which gender, race, and class intersect, and the way in which gentrification has and continues to impact the downtown east side of Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish territory. www.womendtes.com.
You're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM, Vancouver's cooperative radio station. This is Animal Voices, and these are some upcoming events. This Saturday, February 5th, there are two forums in Vancouver which will probably be of interest to our listeners. First, from 2 to 5 p.m., Humans, Whales, and Dolphins. Dr. Jason Cressy, the author of Deep Voices, The Wisdom of Whales and Dolphin Tales, will discuss the long relationship between humans and cetaceans. Later that evening, from 7 to 9 p.m., Dr. Cressy will be joined by other experts for a panel on interspecies communication. What can other species teach our human species? A panel of experts explores the evolving future of human relationships with other species such as horses, dogs, whales, and dolphins. Panelists include Kathy Gibson, who works as a dog and human trainer, and Evelyn McKelvey, who was inspired to become a trained horse whisperer after rescuing an ailing racehorse. Admission is by donation, and both of these forums are taking place at the Canadian Center for Peace, which is 1825 West 16th at Burrard. For more information, you can call 604-731-3101. There are now free and public vegan potlucks in North Vancouver every second Saturday of the month. The next event is next week, Saturday, February 12th, from 7 to 9 p.m. Last time, 22 people attended. Seems like a great crowd. These take place at a restaurant / massage studio, I think, called Bootiful. Bootiful is a gem of a restaurant that offers plenty of organic, raw, vegan, and gluten-free options, including baked goods and raw pizza. In addition to delicious, healthy food and smoothies, they host other events regularly, including a knitting circle every Tuesday from 6 to 8 p.m. And starting next week, there'll be open mics happening every Friday evening. Bootiful is located at 106 West 1st Street in North Vancouver, conveniently right by the C-Bus station. And for more information, you can check out www.buddha-full.ca. Or call 604-973-0231. Upcoming on CBC News Network, there's a couple of films that are animal-related. The Last Grizzly of Paradise Valley is showing on The Nature of Things next Thursday, February 10th at 10 p.m. on CBC News Network. It's also available free online at cbc.ca. The Last Grizzly of Paradise Valley is renowned nature video photographer Jeff Turner. He's returning to his roots and embarking on an exploration of the wildlife in the Cascade Mountains to film one of the handful of grizzly bears still left there. Also, if you haven't had a chance to see it yet, the award-winning documentary Super Size Me is showing on Sunday, February 6th at 10 p.m. on The Passionate Eye on CBC News Network.
They show it a lot on CBC, which is great.
It is great. Yes, I agree.
It's a good film. Who hasn't seen it yet? If you haven't, you need to go see it.
Definitely. Yeah. I'm not sure how much they get into, I don't remember how much they get into, like, behind-the-scenes kind of slaughterhouse stuff. It's mostly health-related, is it not?
I think so. Yeah. It's enough to make you want to barf when you see all that
totally.
McDonald's food
I've
that
heard
he's
people
cramming
say
down your mouth,
that it makes them want McDonald's, which I think there's something psychologically wrong with
that's, that's an addiction.
Yeah. And just finally, there's an international event happening in March. Want to give our listeners a bit of a heads up. It's Meetout 2011, founded by FARM, which is the Farm Animal Rights Movement. Meetout is an annual grassroots event that encourages the public to go meat-free at least for a day. On or around March 20th, thousands of caring people across the U.S. and two dozen other countries get active to host educational events for Meat Out. Activists distribute free food, educate their communities, and ask friends, families, and neighbors to kick the meat habit and explore a wholesome, compassionate diet of fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. Meat Out 2011 serves
aims to serve vegan food to over 10,000 veg-curious passerby and newcomers to veganism. If you're interested in participating, you can sign up to pledge to distribute food. You'll receive free outreach materials, and I think you might even be set up with free food from sponsors of the event. For more information and to sign up, visit the website at www.meatout.org. And if you have any animal or vegetarian-related events coming up that you'd like to let us know about, please email us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com.
Thank you very much, Alyssa. For our first interview, we have Jeff Ertin of the British Columbia Society for the Protection of Animals on the show. Jeff is the Animal Welfare Manager at the BCSPCA. Earlier last year, the federal government announced $3.4 million in funding for animal welfare projects, including new codes of practice for the care and handling of farm animals to be developed under the leadership of the National Farm Animal Care Council. Jeff is here to speak to us today about these new codes of practice. Hello, Jeff, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So before we start talking about the new codes, can you tell us about how the development of the current recommended codes came to be starting in 1980? I understand that this was done to give Canadian SPCAs and humane societies a voice on national farm animal issues.
Yeah, absolutely. The recommended codes, now I wasn't around in 1980, but apparently the recommended codes came into being through some work that the Canadian Federation of Humane Societies, which is sort of an umbrella group for SPCAs and humane societies across Canada, at the national level they were concerned that there was nothing set out to say how farm animals should be treated, how they should be cared for between provinces and across the country, and so it was their idea that these be created, and they brought that forward to the government and to other stakeholders, including veterinarians and scientists and the farming industry groups, and these codes began being developed, and they were developed for about 20 years under the title Recommended Codes of Practice, although there were some must do statements rather than just should statements. There were some must-dos in those codes, but more or less they were mostly recommended codes.
And how has it come to be that these new codes of practice are to be developed? This work is being done under a fairly new entity, the National Farm Animal Care Council. Can you tell us about the process of this undertaking?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So in around 2005, the whole process was renewed, and this new organization called the National Farm Animal Care Council was created, and it has membership from mostly national farming groups, but also SPCAs, veterinarians, and scientists. And this group got together and said, look, we need a new process. The old process for preparing these codes of practice doesn't have a whole lot of public faith. There are public concerns that the codes are just recommended. There isn't a good formalized system for incorporating animal welfare science into the codes. And the field of animal welfare science, trying to use biology to really understand exactly what animals are experiencing, was a really new thing. And so scientists and SPCAs and the public were concerned that this new science being developed to prove that certain kinds of practices, let's say dehorning a calf, would cause pain. So there was new scientific evidence that showed that was causing pain and suffering, and we wanted to see there be a way to make sure that was worked into these codes, and that requirements were created to ensure that animals wouldn't feel pain during these kinds of scientifically proven practices. So what ended up happening is this new multi-stakeholder body, the National Farm Animal Care Council, which we call NFAC. NFAC set about designing this new process for designing codes, and they test piloted it on a new code of practice for dairy cattle, and that happened between 2008 and 2009. I sat on that committee that wrote that code, and I was representing SPCAs. And like I've said before, there were farmers, there were veterinarians, there were government officials and scientists who all sat on that committee and wrote that standard together. And the outcome was that we had a really strong code with a lot of new requirements, actually 30 new requirements for how dairy cattle have to be treated in Canada. And there were very clear requirements and some recommendations stipulated in this code. So for these new codes going forward, they've taken off the term recommended from the title of these codes. So they'll just be codes of practice for the care and handling of farm animals. Because there are some, like I said, in the dairy cow code, there are about 30 firm requirements stipulated, including the fact that if you're going to dehorn dairy cattle, you have to use some kind of pain control, which I think is really, really fantastic. And there are a number of other really very progressive requirements stipulated in these codes that dairy farmers across Canada, for the care of literally millions of animals every year, have to ensure that they're meeting.
So are these new codes that are being implemented, are they actually going to be enforced? Because before, many of the codes were just recommended, non-enforced. Yep. How will these new codes be different in that they will actually be required? Will there be some kind of enforcement to make sure?
That's a really good question, and it's a little bit complicated because these codes, they're not actually regulations, so they're not law, but they're referenced in law. So every province in Canada has animal cruelty legislation that prevents people from causing cruelty to animals. And what those provincial regulations say in each province is you can't cause distress to an animal, you can't be cruel to an animal, unless you're using a generally accepted practice. And so to go back to using the example of dehorning a calf, if the code of practice says that it's a generally accepted practice by the farming industry to dehorn a calf without anesthetic, then that practice is going to be exempt from animal cruelty law. And so what ends up happening is when this code sets out, for example, the dairy code sets out a requirement that says that dairy farmers must use pain control, that means that a dairy farmer who's now not using pain control when dehorning his calves in Canada could be found guilty of animal cruelty law in most provinces. And so there hasn't been a test case on that yet, but we imagine that what would probably happen is if the SPCA got a complaint about a dairy farmer who wasn't using pain control, we would usually try to educate the farmer first and try to gain compliance to make sure that the farmer begins using pain control and issue orders if we have to for the farmer to start using pain control according to what the new code of practice says. If it came to it and the farmer was absolutely resisting, then there's the possibility that a charge could go through for causing distress to an animal, and that the dairy code of practice would be referenced to show that it's no longer an accepted, generally accepted practice by the dairy farming industry to dehorn a calf like that, or castrate it, actually, for example, too, without using some kind of pain relief.
So I understand that there are 8 codes that are to be developed over the next 4 years. Can you tell us about what other kinds of improvements for the welfare of farmed animals that we can expect to see?
Yeah, good question. So I'll tell you, right now there are a few other codes that have just gotten up and running. We've literally just had 1 or 2 meetings for new codes of practice for beef cattle, for horses, for pigs, and also for fur farming, for mink and fox farming. And so these codes of practice are up and running now. Over the next year and a half to 2 years, there will be new requirements and recommendations written for the care of beef cattle, pigs, horses, and fur farming animals. A code of practice for sheep is going to be developed too, and that will be starting soon. And then we'll see what happens next. There would be a couple more that would be done in the next few years too, and those aren't necessarily lined up yet. But I'm hoping that we'll see some really good improvements. I think the dairy code of practice really sets the bar, and so it'll be interesting to see what the committee that's writing the new code for beef cattle will do for some of the same issues that the dairy code addressed. So things like pain relief for dehorning and castration. If the science is similar and shows that that's painful to beef cattle, just like it is to dairy cattle, that will that committee be willing to step up and put some restrictions into place that say that under certain circumstances, you must provide pain relief to animals when you're dehorning them. And there may be other things that can be done, too, like making sure that animals are dehorned or castrated only at the youngest ages when it is less painful and less invasive to the animal. So I'm pretty optimistic that we have a really good process in place to make sure that that scientific evidence is adopted, and it'll come down to these groups of people to work this out, to dialogue and discuss these issues and trying to figure out how we can produce a code that really does meet the needs of these animals in Canada for every species that's being addressed, and also in a way that is the farmers at the table feel is fair for them.
Well, that sounds definitely progressive. It's better than what has not happened in the past, I should say. I know in British Columbia we have a Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act called the PCA Act, which makes it illegal to cause distress to an animal. Under this act, an animal is deemed to be in distress if he or she is deprived of adequate food, water, shelter, ventilation, space, care, or veterinary treatment, injured, sick, in pain or suffering, or abused or neglected. However, if the animal's distress results from a reasonable and generally accepted practice, as you were mentioning before, all of these rules are negated and the animal may not be protected. So I'm wondering if you could touch more on how these new codes of practice may or may not work to protect these animals who now commonly are allowed to be in this kind of distress because it's a commonly accepted practice in the animal agricultural industry. Are you saying that these new codes of practice will address many of these reasonable, generally accepted practices?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's I think they will address many of those practices. And what it comes down to is how good the science is, for a start. And so if you look at something like painful practices like castrating and dehorning, there's very good science that shows that that's painful, and so there'll be quite a lot of pressure on the committees who are writing these codes for cattle and pigs and sheep, who all are exposed to painful practices like dehorning and castration, to make sure that there are requirements put into place that protect those animals from that pain. And the other area where there is the potential for enforcement and ensuring that these farm animals are actually being raised according to the standards in the code is through assurance programs from the farming industry. So right now, for example, Chicken Farmers of Canada, they have a program where they inspect all of their members for food safety standards to make sure that good quality food and safe food is getting, safe chicken meat is getting to people. So now what they've started to do is build on an animal welfare component to that program. And so what they're doing is they're inspecting their members to ensure that their members are meeting the code of practice. So now that could happen, and it probably will happen. I think it definitely will happen eventually with all of the other industry groups too. And so there's going to be some work that's done also through the NFAC to make sure that these farming associations know how to run a program like that, and that they're encouraged to run a program like that, make sure that their members are actually meeting the standards that are in the codes of practice. So in that case, you wouldn't need an animal cruelty investigation or a law case or anything like that to ensure compliance. You would just have the farmer's own association auditing them to make sure that they're meeting the standard. Now, that's what we would call a second-party audit, not necessarily a third-party audit. So you'd have somebody who's coming onto that farm who is has a relationship with the farmer. It's either the farmer's association or it could even be the farmer's veterinarian doing that audit. And so that provides a certain level of assurance that those farm animals are being cared for according to the code. But even better if it was truly third party. So if you had somebody totally independent coming onto the farm to do an assessment.
Well, I understand that the federal government is funding a project that's going to finalize a model for industry-developed animal welfare assessment programs. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
So that would be more third-party?
Well, not necessarily. So the federal government's providing the funding to the National Farm Animal Care Council, and so the federal government has clearly said, we think this should be done, and we're going to pay for all of the experts to get together and talk about how it should be done. But the federal government, at this point anyways, isn't saying we want to actually do the inspections. So what would happen right now is it would probably happen the way that the chicken farmers program is happening, where you have the farming association doing the inspections. And that's a huge step. I mean, that's great to have that kind of inspection done of those farms to make sure that farmers are meeting the standards. And it's not just it's not just inspecting them and auditing them too, but it's giving them help. So you've got a lot of farmers who, you know, maybe they've heard about someone giving pain relief for dehorning before, but they've never done it themselves, and maybe they aren't in as close contact with a local veterinarian as they should be, and maybe they just need to know how to do it. And so you have that support being given to those farmers where someone's coming onto the farm to inspect and make sure that they're meeting the standards, and if they're not meeting the standards, that person can offer them some help to teach them how to do it. And at the beginning, I don't think it'll be third party, but I think it will move there eventually because that's what the public expects. Citizens really expect that farm animals are being treated well, and they're not necessarily just going to take a farmer's word for it because there's such a huge disconnect from urban people and rural people now. And so down the road, I think the public is really going to expect that farmers prove that they're meeting these codes and that they have somebody totally independent come onto the farm to assess that and provide that assurance to the public.
Thank you, Jeff, for coming on the show today to speak to us about the new codes of practice for the care and handling of farm animals that are coming into place here in Canada. For more information on the BCSPCA's involvement in farm animal welfare standards, please visit www.spca.bc.ca. Thanks again, Jeff.
You're welcome. Thanks for talking to me.
You're listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM, CFRO, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC, and this is the news. According to Care2.com, a Minneapolis woman is being investigated in a bizarre case of animal cruelty after she tried to send a puppy through the U.S. mail. The Postal Service said the dog would have died if employees hadn't discovered it. Last week, 39-year-old Stacy Champion walked into a downtown Minneapolis post office with a package that she wanted to send to a relative in Georgia. She explained to the worker behind the counter that she needed to ship the box quickly and chose a two-day priority mail service. The Daily Mail said Ms. Champion was handing over the $22 payment for the postage when the package began to move by itself on top of the counter before falling to the floor. Angela Dodge of the Minneapolis Police Department said, at that point, the clerk and supervisor could hear a sound like panting coming from inside the box. They could hear it in the box. They opened the box and discovered a live puppy in there with no food or water, continued Dodge. Champion said she was mailing Guess, a four-month-old schnauzer, as a gift to a relative. Luckily, the puppy wasn't hurt in the fall and was taken into custody by animal control. A postal inspector said the package that housed Guess had been wrapped so tight that it completely sailed off the air holes. He also explained if the parcel had shipped, it would have been sent by air in an unpressurized and unheated part of a plane. The ordeal would have been a certain death sentence for the little black dog packed inside. Champion was charged with the misdemeanor animal cruelty. She also faces more serious charges for trying to ship a live animal through the U.S. mail. She now has 10 days to appeal her case. If she declines her appeal or loses in court, Guess will be available for adoption. And the news item that is perhaps heaviest on minds this week in BC and echoing around the world is the Outdoor Adventures Whistler worker Robert Fawcett, who gruesomely slaughtered 100 huskies due to a post-Olympic slump in the dog sled tours last April.
This has made national headlines.
It's
really big news.
International, I think. I've seen
a
lot of...
that's what I meant to say. International. Yeah. Definitely.
People are outraged, and as they should be. The worker's application to WorkSafe BC for post-traumatic stress disorder that was leaked and brought the mob-like killings to the forefront of media and public attention outlines the event, including shooting one dog in the face and watching her run away with her head hanging off, some animals climbing out of the mass grave they were thrown into still alive, and claims from the perpetrator that he was bit by some of the dogs who were trying to protect others, as he claims that there were too many dogs to be killed to allow him to carry out his evil out of sight of the next victims. The company says that they tried unsuccessfully to adopt the dogs out, which I'm not buying, since it's coming to light that this is a regular practice within the industry and even the same company to cull animals that are no longer seen as needed or performing at optimum speeds. According to People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, mushers routinely abandon, shoot, bludgeon, or drown dogs when they become ill, don't run fast enough, or are simply unwanted. Going on to cite that in 2005, it was revealed that the largest dog sled tour operation in the United States Krablunik Kennel in Aspen, Colorado, was shooting and killing as many as 35 dogs per year. A Krablunik employee defended the killing, saying that this is part of the cycle of life for the dog sled dog. The latest in the Whistler case is that the BC SPCA has obtained a court order for the WorkSafe BC file pertaining to the event last April, but revealed yesterday that the Compensation Board has filed an application seeking an exemption from the order, arguing that they shouldn't be forced to reveal what they deem to be confidential documents. Marcy Moriarty of the BC SPCA says, one of the reasons WorkSafe BC gives is they fear that if access is granted in this case, people will not give full disclosure for fear of criminal prosecution. The board's application notes that the records of the board are protected from disclosure by law, and it is unreasonable to require the board to produce the records. I think, you know, if you commit a crime, you should have to face...
You
prosecution.
Commit a crime, you pay the time.
Yeah. Like, that's like saying if somebody, like, what about Robert Picton? If he had filed for workers' compensation because looking at the pigs that he farmed every day was giving him post-traumatic stress disorder, would we not be prosecuting him for killing women?
Yeah, it's definitely something that I think will be continue to be explored in the media. We should talk about it next week as well, I think. Thanks a lot for that, Carissa. For our feature interview today, we have Neil DeCruz from the World Society for the Protection of Animals to speak to us about the ancient practice of bear dancing in India, which still continues today. Neil is a UK wildlife biologist possessing a Master of Science degree from the Natural History Museum in London and has previously led field-based conservation research programs throughout Africa and Central America. With a particular interest in wild animal welfare, he has worked for WISPA since 2007 and has been involved in a range of different bear-focused welfare projects, including human-bear conflict, bear cub rehabilitation and release, bear farming, and bear dancing. Hello, Neil, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. The plight of these bears that are forced to dance by humans is something that is perhaps not that well known about here in North America, as from what I can gather, it seems to be a very niche trade, if you can call it that, and is localized far away from us here in Canada, or in your case, the UK. And this is why I wanted to bring this issue to light to our listeners. Can you tell us, please, exactly what is happening to these bears, and why are they kept by humans and made to dance, and what species of bears are they?
Basically, bear dancing is an ancient tradition that until recently was practiced in a number of different countries, both in Asia and in Europe. In short, the bears are made to dance, inverted commas, for paying audiences, basically perform a variety of tricks on demand. But what's actually involved? Well, wild bear cubs are poached from their natural habitat in order to fuel this tradition. Typically, the adult female bear will be killed and parts will be used for example, for the bear trade and traditional medicine. The bear cubs are then transported under poor welfare conditions, and they'll pass along a trade chain until they reach the individual who will actually train the bear to dance. In India, sloth bears are actually the species of bear that are used in this particular practice, and this species is known for its aggressive nature. So in terms of it being niche specific, I would say yes, definitely so. It takes a great deal of skill and specialist knowledge, if you could call it that, to poach and to work with these potentially life-threatening animals.
So who's paying to watch these bear shows? Is it tourists? And is it really that lucrative as a means to support the people who are doing this?
Sure. There's a few different elements to this. The last real economic analysis reported that bear owner could look to earn approximately 3,000 rupees per month, which I guess equates to about 65 Canadian dollars in the high season, and about half of that in the low season. In terms of who's paying to watch this, I'm glad to say there's a kind of a before and after picture here and a bit of a success story. In that prior to any interventions to address this issue that were applied both by the WSPA and other organizations working on it, the practice was highly prevalent in tourist areas. So, for example, areas such as the Golden Triangle in India between Delhi, Agra and Jaipur, think the Taj Mahal, that kind of area. However, since this range of interventions were implemented, bear dancing has now been eradicated from major cities and tourist areas. The few remaining owners operate in extremely inaccessible or lawless rural areas, shall we say, and their income is now far less than before. In fact, many of our reports state now that the majority of their payment is now through in-kind donations, so, for example, shelter for the night or rice or food. So, with regards to the question, is it lucrative? Well, I think in answering this question, it's important to realize that these calendars are extremely poor. So when I say calendar, I should let you know that that's the particular caste in India that's involved in this tradition. So they're one of the most socially marginalized communities in India. The majority are illiterate. They're living well underneath the poverty line, so it's all relative. You know, what doesn't seem like a huge amount of money to you and I, but can actually represent a significant amount to these guys.
Can you talk to us about the living conditions that the bears are kept in once they are caught?
Sure. Yeah, there's a range of different welfare issues that are involved with this particular practice. As I've already mentioned, they're poached from the wild and they're transported long distances. Some estimates report that only 50% of the bear cubs will actually survive the journey. And then once they're there, in order to become a dancing bear, first of all, to prevent human injuries, the cub's canine teeth will be filed down or broken off. And this is a permanent change to the biological change to the animal. Young bears will then have a hole pierced through their nose or snout or palate, depending on what the owner decides to do. And then that's basically done with a red-hot iron rod or something along those kind of lines. And then a rope's passed through the raw wound, and no anesthetic is used. So although initially there's the pain involved with this, but actually what then happens, and contrary to what many people think, is that the bear is then conditioned to dance and obey its owner. And its spirit, if you want, is broken, if you think of it the same way that horses are broken in, by basically aversive conditioning. So the fear of a beating or the fear of physical pain then teaches the bear to dance. It's not actually the pulling and the raw wound itself that will heal and become calloused in the long term. But finally, you've also got all of the complications surrounding the fact that this animal has been removed from its natural environment. You know, that it can't roam or climb or create dens, and so many bears are actually seen to show repetitive signs of stress when they're, for example, tied up by the tree in the calendar community.
I also understand that malnutrition is an issue and that a large number of the bears are blind because of this.
Malnutrition is definitely an issue. They're a very specialized animal with a very specialist diet. So in cases of actual symptoms and diseases that result from that, they're quite common.
Can you tell us more about sloth bears and their lives when they're living out in the wild? And to start with, what would be the natural lifespan for these bears out in the wild?
Nobody really knows, to be honest with you, because they're such secretive animals. But in captivity, which we do know about, sloth bears have been known to live more than 30 years. Some people have even said up to 40. And personally, in terms of bears in the calendar community that are involved in bear dancing, I've heard reports of them reaching 10 or 12 or so.
And what are the populations of sloth bears like in India? Are they on the decline? I understand that the International Union for Conservation of Nature has categorized the species population as vulnerable.
Yep, that's correct. Sloth bears are currently listed as vulnerable on the IUCN Red List, and so they're one step up from being classified as endangered. Again, there are no truly reliable large-scale population estimates for sloth bears, but experts believe that there are approximately 20,000 or fewer animals, and therefore you're looking at less than 10,000 adult animals in the wild. And yes, you're right as well that populations are believed to be in decline. There's strong evidence that their range reduction suggests actually that populations have maybe declined something around the lines of 30 to 49% over the last 30 years. This is largely because of habitat loss and some extent for exploitation for parts, systematic elimination of the pest involved with human-wildlife conflict, and also the dancing bear tradition also contributes to this. The reasons why they're particularly vulnerable to this kind of habitat loss that I mentioned before is because their reliance on lowland areas, which tend to be the places where people also use. And so given the lack of effective measures really to control the rate of habitat loss and exploitation in general, sloth bear populations are expected to continue to decline unless action is put forward.
So how long has bear dancing in India been going on for, and what are the origins of this practice? I mean, why would any human suddenly say, I think it's a good idea to restrain bears and make them dance for entertainment? They're not really dancing. They're just being forced to move about, so it looks like they're dancing. How did this all start?
The calendar are a widely dispersed population of nomadic entertainers that are found throughout South Asia. And they're known for participating in a variety of different entertainment strategies. So as a form of income, for example, think of magic shows and this kind of thing. And so their name and ethnic identity actually is very strongly linked to their skill in handling and training and entertaining with bears and monkeys in particular. So it is a truly ancient profession. It's mm-hmm. The earliest historical evidence suggests that calendars have been performing with bears since the late Vedic era, which is around 1,000 to 700 years BC. So in India, they're known to also have performed in the courts of Mughal emperors since medieval times. So
deeply rooted tradition, then, I see.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, and this practice is actually against the law in India as of 1998 as part of the Wildlife Protection Act. Is there any enforcement of this law coming from the Indian regulatory governances themselves?
Following the Indian Wildlife Protection Act in 1972, actually, some states, as per the law, issued ownership certificates to calendars for their bears, the idea being that as the bears died out, naturally, the tradition would die with them. However, unfortunately, that wasn't the case because forgeries were actually created, so it was allowed to continue. But then, as you say, in 1998, the performance of animals was also completely banned by the government in India, making this age-old profession illegal. Whether it was lack of political will or capacity, I'm not sure, but the fact is that despite this legislation, the problem continued. And this is why various other stakeholders, including WSPA, became involved in the issue.
I just want to remind our listeners that this is the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 FM CFRO in Vancouver, Canada. I'm wondering if you can shed some light on what the mindset is of the society of people who think it's okay to keep these otherwise wild animals and large animals in an obviously unnatural, restrained manner for this service. Now, we were talking a bit about this before. You said that it's a very marginalized community. I would assume that perhaps, you know, this is, as you also said, this has been going on for thousands and thousands of years. Perhaps this is the only way they know, and, you know, it's always been like this for them, and it might be hard to separate themselves from this type of lifestyle when it's ingrained as been normal for them for so long. But what is your take on this?
In terms of mindset, I mean, my personal take on this matter is that calendars are definitely not inherently, inverted commas, bad people. As you say, it's important not to judge them too harshly without looking at ourselves first. For example, it's not too long ago since this practice was actually taking place in countries like the UK. So other forms of animal cruelty also exist in our society.
Very much so, yeah.
But as you said, they're a very distinct and marginalized group that's very proud of its identity, and it's been a traditional form of life for them for as long as they can remember, passed down from father to son. So, you know, the fact that internationally this practice is no longer viewed as acceptable is of course, right, in fact, in light of the terrible cruelty involved. Now, it's also important to look at it from their perspective in order to address the situation. And, you know, from their point of view, overnight international pressure, essentially in the 70s, when they went from royal entertainers, or from Mughal emperors, to outlaws. So, as I said, although it's undeniably an incredibly cruel practice that needs to be stopped, there's no way from getting away from the fact that this has been the only form of income they've had for themselves and their families. And at the time when the legislation was brought in, there was no real assistance to provide them and, you know, with help and to help them acclimatize to the change.
Well, I understand that some of the calendars have expressed that they would like to surrender their bears to rehabilitation, and some have been doing that. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. As a result of all the interventions that have been applied and the increased enforcement and political will, it's become increasingly harder for calendars to actually make a successful living, shall we say, out of this practice, in light of it being illegal and all. So there's definitely been a voice from them, reaching out for help.
So if this is this people's livelihood, what would you say is the solution to ending this exploitation as a means of livelihood? They need to support themselves. So how can they evolve from using captive animals to provide the finances that they need to live? I understand that WSPA is involved in working on this issue with the calendars.
Yeah, as part of our holistic approach, WSPA has been implementing an alternative livelihood initiative. The idea being to give calendars, once they've surrendered their bears, of course, the support that they need in order to achieve a sustainable alternative form of income for both themselves and their families. The process is quite complex, actually. It's initially they're approached by Wildlife Trust of India, which is an Indian-based conservation NGO that we work with in partnership. And they have an anthropologist who actually goes in and lives with the calendars and wins their trust. And he's literally there with them, often in poor living conditions, 24/7, and slowly wins their trust. And once he's got that, he starts to have dialogue with them about the implications of the welfare for the bears, the fact that their future and their livelihood, and really tries to bring them, you know, on the journey and help them to make the decision on their own to initiate the scheme. Once they've done this, they're provided with guidance in selecting and training with a new alternative livelihood. Things like, for example, maybe a small grocery store. Some of the more mechanically minded ones have ended up running motorbike repair shops, a whole range of different livelihoods. And so monitoring is then provided to ensure that this is successful and maintained. But I'd also actually, just to make clear at this point, that we don't just do this to with the ethical concerns of the calendars. There's a wider picture here for the welfare of the bears also, because the idea is if we give them a sustainable alternative livelihood, they won't then, once their bear has been removed, or they've been, you know, they faced prosecution by the law, they don't then go and poach a new bear cub and move to a new location and the process continues somewhere else.
I read that public campaigning against the practice has significantly reduced the number of dancing bears on India's main tourist trails, and that WISPA has been involved with this kind of campaigning in providing welfare awareness programs. Can you talk to us about how this has been successful?
This relates to what I was saying earlier about the fact that there are no bears in tourist areas anymore.
Right, because tourists won't pay for it anymore.
Exactly, and this is due in part to a campaign work instigated by WSPA, WTR and other organizations, which has involved awareness materials such as roadside posters and hoardings, leaflets, bookmarks in hotels, these kind of things, which have basically raised people's awareness about the welfare implications. You know, it's not just a form of entertainment. There's a darker side to what they're seeing. However, now the problem has actually become more of an issue in rural areas, as I mentioned. So, therefore, our ground campaign initiatives have also had to evolve to remain effective. And so now this element of our holistic approach is now focused on raising the awareness of local people rather than international and domestic tourists. And so it's about not just raising awareness, actually, but it's actually changing their attitudes and their behavior. For example, if they see a bear cub poacher operating in their area before, they may have turned a blind eye. Now they actually get in touch with the local police force and report it.
Can you talk to us about where rescued bears have been going to? Are they being rehabilitated in wildlife care centers, for example? I would imagine that if there's any chance for these bears to survive on their own in the wild, they would need a significant amount of rehabilitation before releasing them, if that's going to even happen. And I understand that WISPA just very recently rescued two bear cubs. Can you tell us about that as well?
Yeah, sure. Unfortunately, due to the process that the bear cubs go through and the living conditions as adult bears, those actually end up becoming utilized as part of the practice, can't be released back into the wild. Therefore, following in-depth research in 1998, actually, WSPA and another organization working on this issue, Wildlife SOS, another Indian NGO, worked to lobby the Indian government to get land donated for the purpose of building India's first bear sanctuary. Work started in about 2000. The sanctuary was completed soon after. And basically, when it was finished, WISPA handed over the sanctuary to Wildlife SOS to own and manage, and we made sure that we brought in several international NGOs to support them and ongoing work of the rescuing bears. So a lot of the bears have ended up in this sanctuary. But then in 2004, WSPA started to work on the issue again with our current partners, Wildlife Trust of India, to help speed up the process, because there were still bears remaining on the streets. So as there were already enough lifetime care centres to provide sanctuary, we left this aspect to the organisations already in charge of this. But to be honest with you, right now, the ultimate decision of where a bear goes is down to the Forest State Department. It's their decision. So we would advocate that the bears be sent to a facility, essentially, where their welfare needs can be met. And I'm glad that you raised the fact that, yes, just over 2 weeks ago now, we were related with the local police force in Orissa State and basically helped to seize two bear cubs that were going to enter the practice. So as these bear cubs haven't actually had their palate pierced or haven't had a rope inserted, and they've still basically, as they would have been in the wild, there is the hope that they can actually be rehabilitated and released back. So they're currently in the custody of the Forest State Department there, and are being cared for in a state-run facility. But Wildlife Trust of India, our partners on the ground, maintain a level of interest, shall we say, and make sure that everything is being provided to them they need.
Can you give us an idea of how many working dancing bears remain today in India? I understand that because of the progress that your organization has been making, for example, that there's not that many left.
Exactly. A detailed survey actually was conducted by ourselves and Wildlife Trust of India in 2010. And it appears that the efforts of all the different organizations working on this issue and the government governmental institutions aimed at eradicating have had a significant positive impact. We found evidence of approximately 30 dancing bears To put it into context, back when WSPA first got involved, they were around 2000. So there's a real drop there across the country. But the problem that we've got right now, and why we're aware that work needs to continue and attention needs to be focused on this issue, is because given the size and infrastructure of India right now, it's very difficult to say 100% that there are no dancing bears. So, and the reasons for this is because the remaining calendars are locating themselves in very remote areas that are logistically difficult to access.
Mm-hmm.
They're also difficult, just not geographically, but because of typically localized political instability. Calendars, by their very nomadic nature, are very mobile in nature. Then you've got porous international borders, so they're going across to Nepal and back in again. And to be honest, a lot of the guys remaining are actually powerful members of the local community. Although they're marginalized, they're prepared to use violent methods to retain their bears. So, in short, we're coming down to the last hardcore remaining stalwarts that are really not too keen on giving up this tradition.
Well,
and that's why,
I was just going to say, it looks like there's been a huge amount of success there, and I applaud you for all the work that your organization's been doing. Thank you, Neil, for coming on the show today to speak to us about the dancing bear practice in India. To find out more about WSPA's efforts in animal protection, you can visit the WSPA International website at wspa-international.org or WSPA Canada at wspa.ca. Thank you so much, Neil.
No problem. Thank you.
On next week's Animal Voices show, we will be talking to Stop UBC Animal Research about their recent media breakthroughs and their future plans, as well as the future of the animals at UBC. We'll also have a Valentine's Day treat, and if you have an animal-related story or event, please share with us via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or contact us via Facebook under Animal Voices Vancouver or on Twitter, Animal Voices YBR. And remember that you can download past episodes on our website, animalvoices.org, or on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and remember to be kind to the animals. See you next week, and now we'll leave you with the Green Being song, Cheese Shop of Horrors.
Monster. No, no, no. This is radio. Eco